All right, our next case is number 19-13537, Thomas Reynolds versus Berman Capital 4 LP et al. Mr. Bensinger.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Bill Bensinger for Tom Reynolds, Chapter 7 trustee for the Atheratech bankruptcy estate. The district court below dismissed the trustee's original complaint, finding that the court did not have personal jurisdiction over the defendants because of the derivative jurisdiction doctrine. After giving the trustee an opportunity to amend his complaint, the court dismissed the amended complaint, finding that the court did not have personal jurisdiction over the defendants named in the amended complaint because those defendants did not have sufficient minimum contacts with the state of Alabama. Both of these dismissals were in error, and the trustee asked this court to reverse for three reasons. First, the district court had jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, over the defendants in the original complaint because the court had subject matter jurisdiction pursuant to Section 1334B, that is, bankruptcy related to jurisdiction. And therefore, the federal rules of bankruptcy procedure apply, including Rule 7004, which provides for nationwide service of process. Second, nothing in the derivative jurisdiction doctrine negates or implicates the court's personal jurisdiction because the derivative jurisdiction doctrine at best concerns only subject matter jurisdiction.
And well, let me stop you there. I think you are right that the Supreme Court has not applied the derivative jurisdiction doctrine specifically with regards to personal jurisdiction, but the language that it keeps using seems to encompass personal jurisdiction. What are we supposed to do about that language as a lower court?
Well, Your Honor, the context of Lambert is important for understanding that language. In the context of Lambert, the court was dealing with two issues of subject matter jurisdiction, not personal jurisdiction. The first issue, this federal statute under which the plaintiff brought the case in state court, provided for a federal forum. Was the only place where the court or where the plaintiff could sue. The second issue was that the United States, as an indispensable party, had not waived its sovereign immunity in state court. Both of those are issues of subject matter jurisdiction. The United States Supreme Court in United States versus Mitchell has said that the government's failure to waive or refusal to waive sovereign immunity is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. This court and Lichtenberg versus the Secretary of the Navy said the same thing. The federal government's refusal to waive sovereign immunity is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. So when the Supreme Court in Lambert used the phrase jurisdiction over the subject matter or the party that the court was referring to, the context of that case was the United States as a party that had not waived its sovereign immunity. And that is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. So the context gives this court the clue that it needs to understand that derivative jurisdiction in Lambert didn't have anything to do with personal jurisdiction. And considering the other removal provisions, specifically 1447 and 1448, in that context also points to the fact that derivative jurisdiction does not have anything to do with personal jurisdiction. Consider the following hypothetical, Your Honor. That a plaintiff sues a defendant in state court, and before the plaintiff is able to sue or to serve the defendant removes the case to district court. Under the appellee's broad interpretation of the derivative jurisdiction doctrine, the district court would not have the district court would not have jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, because the state court, having never perfected its personal jurisdiction, never had jurisdiction. And that's not
I don't think that hypothetical works because you're not looking at what the state court actually did before removal, because removal could take place instantaneously. So I'm not sure the hypothetical works.
Well, Your Honor, that was the situation that the appellees, or at least that Fund 4 cites to in their brief on page 28 in the case of Myers versus Indian Hill. The court there said that if there is a defect in the state court service of process, then the court on appeal or the court on removal can't have jurisdiction. Again, though, that mitigates or that goes against what the context of Lambert, number one, but also it goes against the provisions of Section 1447 and 1448 that deal with the process and procedures after removal and the court's ability to perfect service of process after removal. The Third Circuit in Witherow versus Firestone Tire and Rubber said, quote, the concept of derivative jurisdiction that commands dismissal is properly limited to subject matter jurisdiction. And the provisions of Section 1448 make this observation clear, end quote. So the court, the Third Circuit in Witherow recognized that if the derivative jurisdiction doctrine implicates personal jurisdiction, then 1447, 1448 are by and large nullities. That's not what Congress intended when it passed those statutes. And the court, therefore, there's nothing in the derivative jurisdiction doctrine then that implicates or negates the court's personal jurisdiction over these defendants. And the court had personal jurisdiction over the defendants. When the defendants removed this case from the state court to the federal court, the district court, had subject matter jurisdiction under Section 1334B, that is, related to bankruptcy jurisdiction. And this court has said in Rosenberg that when a court, even a district court, is sitting with bankruptcy related to jurisdiction, that the federal rules of bankruptcy procedure apply. And those rules include Rule 7004, which provides for nationwide service of process. The Supreme Court has instructed, and this court has followed, that when there is a federal statute, or in this case, a federal rule that provides for nationwide service of process, then the minimum contacts analysis is performed under the Fifth Amendment, not the 14th Amendment, and the court is to look to the defendant's contacts with the United States as a whole. As the Fourth Circuit put it in Celotex, quote, the question of whether a defendant has minimum contacts with a state court is irrelevant. This is because when a case is before a federal court with related to jurisdiction, the sovereign exercising authority is the United States, not an individual state where the district court is sitting, end quote.
And Mr. Benzinger, has any other court limited the derivative jurisdiction doctrine expressly to subject matter jurisdiction, like you say the Third Circuit has?
Your Honor, the current trend with regard to derivative jurisdiction doctrine is that it doesn't have anything to do with subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction at all. Most courts that have analyzed it, for instance, the Fifth Circuit in Mullins, have said that it doesn't have anything to do with jurisdiction. It is rather a defect in the removal process. And other courts that are bound by those holdings have taken that one step further and said, for instance, the district court for the District of New Jersey in Cofield versus the Department of Justice, the court said that if it is a defect in the removal process, then the removing defendant cannot create that defect, that removal defect, and then take advantage of it by seeking dismissal. In effect, the court in Cofield said that the defect is waived by the defendant that doesn't move for dismissal in state court. They're not the only court that has so held that. In Aguilar versus the Department of Veterans Affairs, the court also in the Northern District of Indiana said the same thing, that a defendant can't, when there is this defect, as the Seventh Circuit has held, when there is a defect in the removal process, then the defendant can't create that defect and then take advantage of it by objecting to the court's jurisdiction. I don't think the court in this case has to go so far as to find that derivative jurisdiction is only an issue of a removal defect. All the court has to do in this case is recognize the district court's error that made, where the court said that derivative jurisdiction implicates personal jurisdiction.
In case we get to it, can you tell us a little bit about your third issue, which is the transfer issue?
Yes, Your Honor. On the transfer issue, there is a presumption that cases are to be heard and decided on the merits, and that did not happen here. And to the extent that the court, the Northern District of Alabama, did not have jurisdiction, it would be appropriate in that case for the court to transfer the case to a court that does have jurisdiction. The defendants here, the primary defendants in terms of fraudulent transfer, Fund 4 and MidCap, have their presence in New York. Fund 4 is organized and existing under the laws of the state of Delaware, but its primary place of business is in New York. The District Court for the Southern District of New York would absolutely have jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, over the defendants to be able to hear this case there in New York. But I don't think that that would be necessary, Your Honor, because this court, the District Court for the Northern District of Alabama, does have jurisdiction over this case. Even if it didn't have jurisdiction under Rule 7004, which the trustee obviously believes that it does, because of the nationwide service of process that 7004 provides, even if the court had to rely just on the traditional specific jurisdiction test or the Calder effects test, the court has jurisdiction. The district court had jurisdiction. Here, the court has jurisdiction under both specific jurisdiction and Calder effects because of the defendant's own conduct and the defendant's agent's conduct. Specifically, several courts have recognized with regard to Calder effects that the mere receipt of a fraudulent transfer is sufficient to satisfy the Calder effects test. The bankruptcy court for the District of New Mexico in N. Ray Akbari made that finding, relying in part on this court's holding in Nordberg versus Grand Financiera, that the mere receipt of a fraudulent transfer alone is sufficient to satisfy the Calder effects test. And the bankruptcy court there in New Mexico isn't the only court. In Eddystone Rios versus Rail in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, the court similarly found that the receipt of a fraudulent transfer is sufficient for the Calder effects test. Ocean Garden versus Blessing in the District of Arizona, the court found that the receipt of a fraudulent transfer is sufficient under the Calder effects test. So these defendants received this $34 million fraudulent transfer, never giving any consideration in return. That caused a harm here in Alabama, and the creditors would not be able to have their judgments paid from here in Alabama from the debtor. That's what the court in the District of Arizona again said in Best Western versus I-70 Hotel. So there was a contact in the form of the receipt of this fraudulent transfer, and there was a harm felt here in Alabama, and that is sufficient, courts have said, under the Calder effects test. And because the court had jurisdiction under 7004 upon removal, and because the court has had jurisdiction under both the Calder effects test and the specific jurisdiction test, the court below erred and this court should reverse.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Bensinger. Mr. Batchelder.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Richard Batchelder from Ropes and Gray, and I'm appearing on behalf of Fund 4 and also Berman Brothers. And before I get into some of the questions that you just asked my brother, let me just say who I represent and what they are. Fund 4 is a private equity fund. Berman Brothers is the general partner of the private equity fund. Neither of those entities has any employees or has any operations. And that's an important point when we get to the jurisdictional issues. But let me answer the question, Judge Jordan, that you asked Mr. Bensinger. You asked, the Supreme Court is quite clear and it says in Lambert that the derivative jurisdiction doctrine applies both to subject matter and the parties. And you asked Mr. Bensinger, has any court anywhere at any time ever read out of the Supreme Court's language the words of the parties? And the answer to that is no, there is not a single case. In fact, not only do we have a century-old doctrine that goes back to 1922, the Supreme Court has used that exact same language in five cases, as most recently as 1991. Now, it's true that those cases don't involve personal jurisdiction, but the Supreme Court doesn't use words loosely, and it's not up to lower courts to say, well, what did they mean when they said, or of the parties? They meant what they said, and that's well, what got...
But on the other hand, to play devil's advocate to my own position, if the Supreme Court hasn't applied language to a specific set of facts, I'm not sure that we're bound to follow that language as a strict precedent thing.
I think respectfully, Your Honor, when the Supreme Court pronounces a doctrine, as they did here, and that doctrine has not been abrogated, and that issue, I think, helps you in terms of understanding congressional intent here, certainly. The Congress has, on several occasions, addressed the derivative jurisdiction doctrine. And each time, it has upheld it with respect to removals under 1452. So there's a conscious decision by Congress to keep in place the doctrine as announced by the Supreme Court. And the doctrine as announced by the Supreme Court has applicability in cases not necessarily on the facts of the case before the Supreme Court, but broad applicability on the language that the Supreme Court uses. And that's true for a number of different doctrines that the Supreme Court has followed, because not every case is going to fit neatly in the same fact pattern. And so when the Supreme Court announces a doctrine of broad application, it is binding on lower courts. And that's what Judge Axson said. And not only has no court ever adopted Mr. Benzinger's argument, every court that has addressed that issue has agreed. And there are cases in the Seventh Circuit, the Block case, the Second Circuit, the Meyer case, the Ninth Circuit, the Anistead case. All these cases in those circuits all addressed on the facts the situation of the personal jurisdiction issue and not subject matter jurisdiction, and all said that the language in Lambert Run was binding on them. And
all right, let me ask you to assume for a moment that we are not bound by the Supreme Court's language with regards to the parties. How does the derivative jurisdiction doctrine make sense with regards to personal jurisdiction as opposed to subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, the derivative jurisdiction doctrine makes a lot of sense in the abstract, and specifically to the personal jurisdiction issue. Think about the whole point of a removal. The case was brought here in state court. The trustee had brought over 100 adversary proceedings in the bankruptcy court. But for this case, the trustee decided, I want to get a little bit of extra leverage and I want to bring that case in state court. This was the second time he had done that. He'd sued the directors and officers first, and it was the day after that case settled that he filed this case, which was on the eve of the statute of limitations. So he rolled the dice, filed in state court. My clients, which at the time there were 32 separate defendants that he sued, all the defendants moved and removed the case, as was their right. Now, when you remove a case, you should not be worse off than you were on jurisdictional issues than you were in the state court. Otherwise, that would be punitive, right? So
why should that be the case? You as a removing defendant understand what the state court's jurisdiction rules are, and you presumably understand what the federal court's jurisdiction rules are. And for one reason or another, you choose to get into a federal forum because you think that'll be a better forum for you. Why don't you buy into the federal court's jurisdiction rules as to personal jurisdiction?
And one of the federal court jurisdictional rules is a century-old doctrine announced by the Supreme Court that's been universally followed by every circuit court that has addressed the issue. And so absolutely, we were using our right to remove the case and knowing what the doctrine applied. That's why we raised it in the first instance. This isn't one of the cases that went to judgment and then the defendants at that point, after they lost, said, oh, we've got a derivative jurisdiction argument. That's not our case. Our case is we removed it, we raised it right away. Judge Axson said, I'm bound by the Supreme Court, says it right in the language of the decision or of the parties. Supreme Court said it five times, as most recently as 91. Congress has allowed that to stay in place. Every circuit court that has addressed the issue has found that the derivative jurisdiction doctrine exists and applies to personal jurisdiction issues. So when we removed it, we weren't losing that argument. We were gaining that argument because we were going to be in federal court, and we had the federal derivative jurisdiction argument. The trustee could have filed this case initially in the bankruptcy court and avoided all this. He chose not to. And he doesn't get to be better off because he made a tactical decision to file in state court and we exercised our right to remove it to federal court and take advantage of the derivative jurisdiction doctrine. That doctrine's there.
But what you just said indicates that the derivative jurisdiction doctrine may not make any sense on the personal jurisdiction side.
No, I'm not saying. I think it makes perfect sense.
If the trustee filed in federal court, you said he would have had, the court would have had personal jurisdiction, right?
If he had filed in bankruptcy court.
Okay? Which is federal court. Which is federal
court. Right, federal bankruptcy court. And this is where I get to the point here that I think is really important not to lose. The trustee's tactical decision.
So if he files, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'll give you a chance to finish up, but I don't want to lose this thought. So if he filed in federal bankruptcy court, there would be jurisdiction over your clients. But if he files in state court and the case gets removed to federal court under bankruptcy removal jurisdiction, then the jurisdiction is gone.
It's very important point that you're making, Judge. And this is why he's arguing that I can fix a problem after the fact by relying on Rule 7004, Bankruptcy Rules of Civil Procedure, that once I'm in federal court, I can fix the problem that existed in the state court. He can't do that under the derivative jurisdiction doctrine. No case has allowed that. So what's happening here is we were in federal district court. We were able to remove
your argument, I'm sorry, is I just want to understand it. Because the trustee made a tactical decision to file in Alabama court, in Alabama state court, he could not transfer. He can't get a do-over and argue now that the bankruptcy rule should apply. He could have done that initially. You don't get to have a sort of like amending the complaint. You don't get that opportunity.
Exactly. What happens, Judge, is there's a point in time that you look at whether or not the jurisdiction exists. And this is right in that wonderful quote from Lambert, from the Supreme Court. If the state court lacks jurisdiction of the subject matter or of the parties, the federal court acquires none. And it's a moment in time. Removal happens. If the state court lacks it, the federal court acquires none. And that can't be fixed. And the removal here, it's important.
Haven't courts said, I think the Supreme Court said this, that the federal rules of civil procedure apply when there's removal. Federal service of process applies when there's removal. You can amend your complaint. This doctrine doesn't prevent amendments to complaint, things like that, right? I mean, you would concede that the federal rules apply to this case.
Absolutely. Right?
So then if that's the case, if the federal rules apply, and if you remove this under bankruptcy-related jurisdiction, then I think we've said that the bankruptcy rules apply. And if the bankruptcy rules apply, then why doesn't this rule that allows nationwide service of process apply?
Because before you get to the question of nationwide service of process, you have to look at, did the state court have jurisdiction of the parties at the time of the removal, because the federal court acquired none. So it's in a moment in time. And
what if the parties hadn't been, what if one of the parties hadn't been served, right? One of the parties hadn't been served, the other parties removed. What rule would govern service of process in that party that hadn't been served?
That happened here. There were parties that had been served in the state court, parties that hadn't been served in the state court. It doesn't matter. What matters
what rule would tell you how to serve those parties?
Well, you'd first have to prevail on the derivative jurisdiction doctrine.
Well, why? The parties hadn't even been served yet, so they're not even there.
Right, it doesn't matter. As Judge Jordan said earlier, removal can happen lickety-split.
Right, well, I guess my point is the parties haven't been served, so they haven't even shown up to argue any sort of derivative jurisdiction.
Well, the way the removal statute works, it's interesting, and it was like a tutorial to look at the arcane rules on this, but you remove on behalf of the parties that have been served. Okay, that's how you remove it. And all of them have to be in unanimous agreement on the removal. We had that. And so everybody that had been served, removed, we then had the right to exercise the derivative jurisdiction doctrine, be in federal district court, not bankruptcy court. And whatever would happen going forward, federal rules of evidence, rules of civil procedure, none of that matters to the question of derivative jurisdiction doctrine. Because if it did, think about it, if it did, then the derivative jurisdiction doctrine would be meaningless. Because you could always say, well, I can use Rule 7004 now, and I can serve everybody, nationwide service of process. So I see my time's up. May I finish the
thought? You can finish up, go right ahead.
Yes, so if it were the case that you could say post removal, during the argument on the derivative jurisdiction doctrine, you know, I can fix all this. I've got this bankruptcy rule of civil procedure. This case applies to bankruptcy rules, and I'll just fix it, and I'll just serve everybody under that. That would mean the derivative jurisdiction doctrine would have no applicability ever in a case like this. And no court has said that.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Batchelder. Mr. Pruder?
May it please the court, my name is Charles Pruder, and I represent FLE MidCap, sort of a forgotten party here on this appeal. On top of the arguments for affirmance based on the derivative jurisdiction doctrine and the lack of personal jurisdiction over MidCap based on the original complaint, MidCap additionally and alternatively urges the court to hold that the trustee waived his right to appeal the dismissal of MidCap as well as the Berman Limited Partners or LPs who are situated similarly. And here's why. After the district court dismissed the original complaint without prejudice, the trustee filed a motion to amend and represented to the court that he was dropping MidCap and the LPs. The trustee said, of primary importance, the amended complaint drops MidCap Financial and the limited partners as defendants. The trustee then did in fact drop them from the amended complaint and proceeded only against the two main Berman parties. Now, to be sure, if the district court dismisses a claim on the merits or with prejudice, the plaintiff may appeal that ruling later without including it in an amended complaint. But this merits dismissal rule does not apply here. The district court dismissed the original complaint on personal jurisdiction grounds and without prejudice. This was not a final merits decision. While the 11th Circuit does not appear to have fully addressed the consequences of a non-merit dismissal, the 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 9th Circuits have reasoned that when a district court dismisses a claim not on the merits without prejudice and a chance to amend, then the plaintiff waives the right to appeal if it files an amended complaint omitting that claim. In effect, it's a non-appealable voluntary dismissal. So that's the rule that applies here. Judge Axon clearly pointed out the jurisdictional defect in her order, which is document 107. She explained that although the trustee had argued to the court that MidCap had, quote, business dealings in Alabama, the trustee had made no such factual allegations in the original complaint. So
can
at
I
this
ask,
point-
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
How does this play out? Let's say that this in a different sort of case, because if we adopt your argument, I think it's a very tricky thing to write. So let me ask you the question this way. If the district court dismisses a defendant without prejudice for lack of personal jurisdiction, right, tells the plaintiff, you can amend, but there are no more facts that the plaintiff can add to amend, but the plaintiff has to amend as to the other defendants, what happens to the dismissal of the first defendant that gets dropped?
I think that in this situation, the answer it can be found in what unfolded here with the motion to dismiss and the motion to amend on the part of the trustee. I think the trustee could have cured the defects identified by the district court with the actual factual allegations regarding the business dealings that had been represented to the district court in the motion to dismiss briefing.
You may be right about that, but that's not the case I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the scenario where, okay, we'll use your client as an example. The district court dismisses the first complaint for lack of personal jurisdiction, right? It dismisses the complaint for lack of personal jurisdiction as to a couple of other defendants too. It tells the trustee to file an amended complaint. The trustee files the amended complaint, but it has nothing else it can add with regard to your client. It does have things it can add with regard to the other defendants, and the case goes on. Once there's a final judgment in that case as to the other defendants, can the trustee appeal the dismissal of your client for lack of personal jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that the path forward there is one that's laid out by the Third Circuit in the Atkinson case, which is 473 F3rd 506. And the court there says that the plaintiff in that situation needs to make it clear that it is standing on its pleadings with respect to that defendant that hypothetically would be in MidCap's position. Perhaps a statement in the amended complaint, perhaps a statement into the motion to amend. Where that is starkly contrasted with this situation, however, is where the trustee in the motion to amend explicitly represented to the court and announced to MidCap and the LPs that it was dropping those parties from the complaint and move forward after having made that representation, Your Honor.
Can I ask
Mr. Peter?
You might have asked a question.
Sure. No, not at all. Go right ahead.
So there's a case that this court issued called Dunn, where we said that the question in a situation like this is whether the amendment would have been futile given the district court's reasoning. And so could you just address that? Is this a situation, given Judge Axson's reasoning on the personal jurisdiction issue, would it have been futile for the trustee to try to have added your client back in?
Your Honor, to address the Dunn case first, that was a case at the district court that had been dismissed under Rule 12b-6, which by default operates as a decision on the merits. That case also involved the omission of only a claim against the same party, whereas in this case we have the omission of an entire party. MidCap, the defendant, and as the Third Circuit explained in the Atkinson case, the equitable principles of waiver should apply more strongly when you're dropping an entire party. I think finally, Your Honor, with respect to what Judge Axson found here in her order, she specifically identified this lack of a valid factual allegation regarding the business dealings, in spite of the arguments that there had been these business dealings that would support personal jurisdiction. So I think that the way forward and a way that would comport with the Dunn case from this court is would have been for the trustee to have amended the complaint to actually bring actual factual allegations regarding those business dealings. Or perhaps if that representation regarding business dealings was somehow inaccurate, perhaps to correct the record and represent then to the court that in fact there were no such business dealings. And the trustee would simply be standing on its pleadings against MidCap, but that didn't happen. We had instead an affirmative representation that MidCap would be dropped.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Prater. Mr. Bensinger, you've got your rebuttal time. Mr. Bensinger, I think you're on mute.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. A text without a context is a pretext. And that's what the defendants want this court to adopt. The pretext that the Supreme Court's language or the parties in Lambert means personal jurisdiction in a case where personal jurisdiction was not the issue. My friend on the other side says the Supreme Court does not use words loosely, but the Mullins Court, the Fifth Circuit, analyzing Lambert said that they in fact do use words loosely. They use the word jurisdiction rather loosely. They use the word jurisdiction in a context that jurisdiction was not implicated. And so therefore, at best, to the extent that the phrase the parties does mean in Lambert does mean personal jurisdiction, it is dicta. And as this court recognized in Bluebell versus Kay just 2 years ago, dicta is not binding, even dicta from the Supreme Court. Judge Brasher asks about a case where a defendant can amend after removal. The case that I think that Judge Brasher was looking for was Freeman versus B Machine Company. And in that case, it started in state court, got removed to federal court. After it got removed, the plaintiff wanted to add a federal claim that it could not have brought in state court. Supreme Court said the federal rules of procedure apply, and they apply as soon as it gets removed, and therefore they can amend. Well, it's the same thing here. The federal rules of bankruptcy procedure apply as soon as this case got removed from state court. Now, the defendants acknowledge that, but they say all the rules except 7004, Your Honor, that's what apply. And finally, my friend on the other side said that he invoked almost the Erie Doctrine, that there has to be a similar outcome between state and federal. As the Supreme Court recognized in Guarantee Trust, that's only applicable in diversity jurisdiction cases. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you all very much. We appreciate
it. Thank you.